KBOO is currently in our membership fall drive, our fall membership drive, of course. So now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to our website at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Tara Hurst, the Executive Director of the Health Justice Recovery Alliance. Welcome to the show, Tara.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. To start out here, can you tell me a little bit about your organization?
Sure. So the Health Justice Recovery Alliance has been working to ensure that the implementation of Ballot Measure 110 was done as the voters intended. And for us, that really means making sure that we are moving addiction from a criminal justice response to a healthcare response, and also really making sure that, you know, we know that communities of color have been, and especially Black, Latino, Indigenous, Tribal, and Native communities specifically, have been over-incarcerated and under-treated. And so making sure that the services that are being stood up are really focused on culturally and linguistically specific care, and ensuring that we are getting the right services into the community that are really going to help people get onto the road to recovery.
State lawmakers announced the creation of a joint interim committee on addiction and community safety response. From your perspective, where does that fit into addressing the addiction crisis and Measure 110?
So I think it's an important committee because it starts zooming out on this is not a, what we're feeling in a lot of our communities is not as a result of Measure 110, but because we want something to attach what we're seeing onto. Measure 110 has been a very reliable scapegoat, if you will. And so this committee is really saying, okay, let's zoom out. We have an addiction crisis in Oregon. There's an addiction crisis in the all over the country, but we're focused on Oregon, obviously, because it's the Oregon State Legislature. So what is it that we need to really be effective in meeting in making sure that we have rapid access to care for people when they need it? So currently we have people lined up outside of Hooper Detox every day trying to get a detox bed. That is not acceptable, right? That is not how we're going to solve our addiction crisis. We also have, I think it's 3 out of 10 folks who have gone through Hooper Detox, and this isn't any, you know, detox is about 3 to 7 days predominantly because it's a medically like supervised space where to make sure that you don't die as you're coming off of substances. And we know that 3 out of 10 folks leave Hooper without housing, also unacceptable. So there's a lot of gaps in care that we need to be looking at the bigger system and figure out, what do we need? We know that we're at a 50% capacity of what we're supposed to have. That's according to the OHSU and the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission study that came out last year. We also know that, like, sometimes these problems feel too big, and so we just keep talking about them and don't do. And so I think my hope for this joint committee is that we can have not just conversations about here's the best way to treat addiction and here's all the services that we need, because that's a conversation that absolutely has to happen and needs to get solidified. But then it's, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to, you know, make sure that all these different providers who are ready to open up new recovery houses, who are able to open up new detoxes, that they are getting funded right now so that we can be building out this system. And then I think it also is trying to address that there are some community safety concerns, and we don't necessarily have the best response, right? We know that police in most communities are understaffed and aren't able to address all of these issues. And quite frankly, most folks, including the police, don't want to be the ones having to respond to somebody who's in a mental health crisis. And they're not the right people. So how do we build out a community safety response that is really cognitive on best practices and evidence on what's the best for the community member, especially the one in crisis? And I don't think it's only the person who is having an actual mental health crisis at the moment, but it's also the folks around, and it's also, you know, our local businesses, and making sure that we can get our spaces back to being livable, but not by harmful and harsh punishments, but by having the right people addressing the issues that they are most suited to address. So my hope is that that's the conversation we'll be having in that joint committee. It's got a lot of thoughtful folks on it, and I feel confident that we'll be able to work through a lot of the issues and continue to zoom out. Measure 110 didn't create this problem, and it's not going to solve this problem. So how do we make sure that we are really looking at all of the things that need to happen in order for us to really treat this addiction crisis as a crisis, and come up with sustainable and stable solutions that can really move us forward long term, and not these quick Band-Aid fixes that don't fix anything.
There's also a political group that formed recently with a plan to quote-unquote fix Measure 110, and it's attracted large donations already from some of Oregon's wealthiest people. They want to recriminalize the possession of hard drugs and shift oversight of the programs away from the Oregon Health Authority. What are your thoughts on their plan, on that effort?
So they're not fixing Measure 110, they're repealing it and gutting it. So I think we need to be really clear about that. This whole idea that they're fixing Measure 110, and unless fixing measure, they're doing things that Measure 110 didn't even address, like dealing and creating, and they're creating new crimes for people. They're also, I think what they're doing is doubling down on the criminal justice response. So they're saying we need to force people into treatment. Even though we don't have the treatment, we don't have the public defenders, and we don't have the jail beds, which would be extremely costly, if that was even what the voters wanted, right? The voters were very clear. We want a healthcare response because addiction is a healthcare issue. How we get there, I recognize that we're all grappling with, right? What is the best way to do that, and how do we do that in a way that is causes the least amount of harm? And that's really important. So this Fix 110 is not a fix, it's a repeal. And it does even more damage because it takes all of the funding, even though they're not willing to be forthright about this, it takes all the funding away from the Measure 110 services that have just gotten up and running, are doing incredible things for communities across our state. And it diverts it to cities, counties, schools, and to the criminal justice response, so the diversion. $200 million is not going to be enough to do that. And then it talks about we need to create treatment and detox and prevention. I think we 1,000% do need to invest in all those things. That is the CCO's job, to invest in clinical services, the detox and treatment centers. And I mean, everybody's been reporting on it. They have between $400 and $800 million in profits. I think that we shouldn't be giving them a pass and using Measure 110 funds for that, right? They have the funding. They need to figure out what's the best way to use that, and we need to pressure that to happen. And then it takes it out of OHA, but it doesn't, because the Alcohol Drug Policy Commission is in OHA. So it shuffles the deck chairs, and what it does, more importantly, is it takes away the Oversight and Accountability Council. And the Oversight and Accountability Council is the first of its kind. I mean, this is a group of people with lived experience who are predominantly from communities who've been most impacted by the war on drugs, have the professional and lived experience to be able to determine where these funds need to be and will have the greatest impact on the communities. So it takes it away from the bureaucracy, and it's really about getting the money right out into the provider's hands, who can have the biggest and best impact on folks at the street level. It's not, and so to say that they're not taking the services means that they need to find $1 billion in order to fund all the things that are in their measure. And that's just not going to happen. And then it promises automatic expungement, which is not something that is readily available to anyone. And it's not something that our state has the systems to do. So I think that the folks who are giving money to this campaign, you know, when we talk to providers, what could you do with $700,000? I mean, we could be opening up new stabilization housing. We could be opening up new recovery housing with that money. We could increase outreach downtown by a significant amount. So we need to be solving for the problems that are real, and Measure 110 is not the problem. It's part of a solution, and we need to continue to, you know, make it better. And fix is fine, but that is not a fix. That's a repeal. So I think it's just really important for people, when they're getting their information, to recognize that, that when you read the measure, it is a repeal, and then it's like a repeal plus, plus, plus. There's a lot of extra added bonuses in there. If you support the criminal justice response to addiction, we know that 25 states have higher overdose death rates than Oregon, and they all have higher, stiffer criminal penalties for people who use drugs. So criminal penalties doesn't equal safer, and it doesn't equal less deaths. It amounts to a higher cost for poor outcomes. You're 27 times more likely to die 2 weeks out of leaving jail or prison of an overdose. It is not the appropriate place to get health care, and it's a very expensive place to get health care. So it's not solving the problem, it's making the problem worse. And I hope that voters and the public can see and read between the lines, or just read the lines of the measure, and you'll see this is really harmful policy.
Well, you mentioned that Measure 110's implementation has really started in terms of the services about 11 months ago. What do we know so far about what kind of impact it's had?
We know that in the third quarter, we've seen a 174% increase between quarter one, and quarter one is July 2022. Through October, and then October through December is quarter two, just to give everybody a grounding in what we're talking about. So between quarter one and quarter three, we've seen 174% increase in screenings. That's checking in, seeing like, what do you need? What kind of medical care could you need? Do you need housing, addiction treatment support? 106% of assessments. We've gotten 104% increase in SUD treatment in three quarters. We've had a 143% increase in peer support services. Housing services saw 190% increase, and our harm reduction services had a 91% increase in services in the past three quarters. We're about 6 months behind with a data lag. And so just even in the beginning, when most people hadn't even gotten their full funding, those are the types of numbers you're seeing. The impact is significant, right? So because they can't take it all out of were these unique visits, it's hard to give exact numbers, but you're seeing 7,000 people or encounters with treatment in just a quarter, 11,000 people engaging or services being given in peer support and housing. You're looking at 2,000 people a quarter being able to access housing services. So it's an extremely significant amount of access that is shifted. But remember that we had a fully starved, broken system. So these types of numbers, even though they're extremely impressive, they're not going to be felt by the full community because we have lines out the door for detox still. We still have major wait lists for housing. We have a lot of work to do to keep growing. We still need a lot of inpatient beds. We're at 50% of our capacity. So that means that we only have half of the amount of treatment spaces for the people that need it. And that's what we're facing. And I just really want to focus on that and not on these kind of short, quick political stances, because people are dying.
That was Tara Hurst, the executive director of the Health Justice Recovery Alliance, speaking with me about recent legislative actions concerning Oregon Measure 110, the drug decriminalization and treatment law. More information about her organization at healthjusticerecovery.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Street Roots Indigenous Affairs reporter Melanie Henshaw talking about her new article. It's called Tribal Forests Underfunded. Tribally managed forests lack funding to address myriad issues, new report finds. Welcome to the show, Melanie.
Hi, Althea. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. So your new piece breaks down the Indian Forest Management Assessment Team 4, released by the Intertribal Timber Council, and it talks about the status and needs of tribally managed forests. To start out here, who is on this council and what are they analyzing?
It's a nationwide group comprised of various tribal nations, Alaska Native corporations, and other individuals committed to tribal forestry. And for the report, they convene forestry experts to examine tribal forests and forestry while visiting dozens of tribal nations, meeting with natural resource departments, tribal governments, and tribal citizens.
What is the acreage like of Oregon forests that are tribally managed?
So 7 of the 9 federally recognized tribal nations in Oregon manage approximately 516,000 acres of forest land. It fluctuates as land is being brought into trust all the time. And there's also some acreage that may be managed outside of trust or in other ways operated by the tribe. So that's not accounted for in the 516,000 acre number.
So in looking at this report, what were some of the highest priorities for tribes when it comes to managing forests?
Tribes have a slightly different vision when it comes to forest management than the U.S. Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management. Generally, the vision for tribal forestry is more aggressively focused on sustainability and protection, and tribal members rate highly the ability to collect non-timber forest products and access their forest for cultural and spiritual means much higher than revenue generation through timber harvest.
What are some examples of non-timber forest products?
Right. So it covers a wide range of products that can be everything from wild mushrooms to berries, fish, grasses, any non-timber product that can be taken out of the forest. And their uses are many. They're used as food sources, as medicines, used in ceremonies for crafting. And that can be through direct use, either by the tribal member or could be used for sale or barter. And like I said, they're very, very closely tied to spirituality, physical and mental health.
Now, you also cover that this report outline some of the challenges that there are when it comes to harvesting these non-forest timber products, and wildfires can play into that. Can you tell me about that aspect?
Some of the issues that these NTFPs, as they're sometimes called, are facing are, you know, habitat destruction, declining populations, and now habitat destruction could obviously come through the form of wildfires. And some of the other issues that are touched on in this report is one of the ways that wildfires are managed are through what's called prescribed burns or controlled burns, which are healthy for the forest, but are often set using a tool called a drip torch, which essentially drips liquid fire onto the ground. I'm not a scientist, so that's my non-scientific explanation of a drip torch. But essentially, that results in chemicals being dripped onto the ground. And in the Pacific Northwest, a really common weaving material is bear grass. And this report found that sometimes the contaminants from drip torches can end up on bear grass, which is then harvested by weavers. And often the weavers are putting this material in their mouths. So that could lead to potentially negative health effects for folks who are using that product. That doesn't say that prescribed burns are negative or bad. It's just a potential consequence of one of the tools that's used.
Yeah, you also mentioned this report that King 5 Washington did about fire retardant and how that impacts some of these products. Can you talk about that too?
Yeah, absolutely. So King 5 Washington recently released a report that found that the USFS, the U.S. Forest Service, dropped retardant on or near water 45 times in the Pacific Northwest between 2012 and 2019, including waterways that are in the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest. And that is negative because the retardant that is dropped in the waterways is harmful to fish and other wildlife. And the report found that the errant retardant drops killed thousands of fish, including endangered steelhead and salmon species.
Well, to go back to what you identified in the title of this article, underfunding is one of the biggest difficulties that tribes face when it comes to forest management. Can you break that down? What role does funding or lack thereof play in how this goes?
Right, absolutely. So tribal forests are funded at about one-third of the amount per acre as U.S. Forest Service and BLM managed land. So that underfunding has contributed to many issues that they highlight in the report, such as the infrastructure that tribes have in their forest is in bad condition. And when I'm referring to infrastructure, I mean forest roads and the like. Then tribal forestry departments are understaffed, and the staff that they do have are working with low pay. And the low pay essentially means that these jobs that they have in tribal forestry departments can't compete with equivalent jobs in BLM or the U.S. Forest Service. They have trouble attracting folks to work these jobs in tribal forestry departments. And that issue is also compounded by the fact that there's often poor housing. Now, these underfunded and short-staffed tribal forestry departments are having to contend with immediate threats to tribal forests, like pests, disease, and wildfire.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Can you break down some of the threats that those pose?
Wildfire obviously is a threat that we're facing a lot here on the West Coast and, of course, in Oregon. And these wildfires are burning more and more land, and it's exacerbated through climate change. Due to heavy fire suppression tactics over the past century, these fires are burning extremely hot and even destroying species that are adapted to some level of fire. And other issues that tribal forests are facing are pests like the emerald ash borer, which decimates ash trees, and sudden oak death, which affects oak species, and that's a disease. And now those are two types of wood that are extremely valuable to tribes. So for tribal forestry departments, they need funding, but they also need capacity they need more staff and more trained foresters in order to address these threats like wildfire, pests, and disease.
How do controlled burns play in? You mentioned this a little bit earlier, but are there times that a controlled or prescribed burn isn't a successful tactic based on the state of forests today?
Yeah, so I actually, in my conversation with one of the co-chairs of the Intertribal Timber Council, he said that essentially once trees and understory, foliage in the understory reaches a certain point of maturity, controlled burns are no longer going to be an effective tactic for managing that forest. And you need to go in with what's called mechanical thinning, which is essentially chainsaws, and you're cutting things down. Or they can also put like a toxin into the tree that will kill it, like inject the tree with a toxin. And those are methods that can be used after the certain point has been reached in which prescribed burns would no longer be an effective way to manage that particular forest land.
Yeah, I thought that point was especially interesting. I appreciate you explaining it. What did the report conclude about tribal timber production?
So tribal timber production in the surveys that the ITC conducted was found to be important, but less important to tribal members than non-timber forest products and forest protection, but still important because timber production is used to generate revenue that's often used to fund programs to support tribal members directly, like housing, education, and healthcare. So tribes often are not able to harvest the what's called the maximum allowable cut, which is essentially a metric that's set each year that determines the maximum amount of timber that an entity can harvest from a particular area. Tribes are typically not meeting that, and that's for a variety of reasons, including, as I mentioned, a focus and priority on forest protection and sustainability over revenue generation. But nonetheless, the report quantified how much money was being lost when tribes are not reaching the maximum allowable cut, and found that nationwide it's about $40 million per year lost. So it, like I said, it's a complex issue where tribes do want to harvest timber for revenue, but it's often not the number one priority. And now I'm speaking very generally here. There's more than 300 tribes in Turtle Island that manage forest land. This report just characterizes generally tribes having a stronger focus on forest protection and sustainability while maintaining some level of importance for revenue generation as well.
So where does the report go from here?
Right. So this is a congressionally mandated report that is produced every 10 years. This is the fourth such report, and from here, it will be presented to Congress before a Senate committee and also before a House committee, where the researchers will present their findings, make their recommendations, and, of course, be questioned by senators and congresspeople on their findings and recommendations as well. And it's looking like potentially this year they might actually hold this hearing outside, which would be kind of interesting.
That does sound interesting. What are the takeaways that you hope readers and listeners get from this story?
Well, I think it's important to note that this is, again, more than 500,000 acres of forest land in sharing space with Oregonians. And so this is important because forestry management practices is, I'll say, a hot topic here in the Pacific Northwest. And I think it's important to highlight that the tribes are managing a significant amount of land and they're doing things a little bit differently. And when I spoke with, you know, one of the co-chairs who wrote this report, he said that generally tribally managed forests are in somewhat better condition than forests managed by BLM or the U.S. Forest Service.
If our listeners are interested, where can folks find a copy of your work for themselves?
Well, you could look us up at streetroots.org, but I would certainly recommend picking up an issue this week from one of our 200 plus vendors that's located throughout the metro.
Love it. Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up here?
Final thoughts are, it's really interesting to see the difference between tribally managed and non-tribally managed forests. And I encourage you to check out this report or the summary to kind of get a better idea of how folks place their focus when their priorities are different.
Well, Melanie, thank you so much for taking the time to walk us through this.
Althea, thank you for taking the time to ask.
That was Melanie Henshaw, the Indigenous Affairs reporter at StreetRoots, talking with me about her new article. It's called Tribal Forests Underfunded. Tribally managed forests lack funding to address myriad issues, new report finds. More information available at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO's annual fall